welcome to the Janet Foster Show. It's a great Sunday afternoon here in Los Angeles, coming to you live for all you Southern California listeners. And we are growing across the country. We have folks listening to us from Florida to New York, Massachusetts, Illinois. A lot of people in Chicago have been shouting out, and thanks for the love. And definitely, this is the show where you get real talk you can act on, and it's starting to catch on with everybody. Today's show, we are going to get down to it. We're going to kick off a multi-part series, I'm excited about talking to today's guest. Today, we are going to put it down and start the conversation by talking about race and culture. And I'm asking the question, are we living in a post-racial America? For all of you listening, give me your thoughts by getting social with me on Facebook at Janet Foster. So just go ahead and put a post up on the episode page, the post that we have for today's episode, and give me your thoughts on, do you really think that we're living in a post-racial America? And also, you can hit me up on both Twitter and Instagram at Janet D. Foster, and that's Janet D. for Deborah Foster. Definitely, I want to hear from you. Just thinking about this subject of race makes a lot of people uncomfortable, and it should be, because it's something that everyone treats like it's they know it exists, but they act like that they can't see it. And sometimes that's cloaked in a lot of, I'd say, verbal euphemisms. Sometimes there's other things that people say out of nervousness or being uncomfortable. And it's from all angles. And what I mean by all angles, it doesn't matter the person's ethnic background or not. Everybody has those kinds of mechanisms. And particularly since this show has a very large audience of Generation Xers and Millennials, and I can't forget my cool baby boomers out there that are just, we're growing by the week in terms of followership. But I have to say, my generation, Generation X, and the Millennials, we are two generations that were basically born in an integrated society here in America, and I'm specifically going to talk about the United States. We don't know what it was like when things were legal. That's the most polite way I'll put it. We don't know, but chances are we either have parents, definitely Gen Xers, we have parents that lived during those times, may have been in school during those times where separate was supposed to be equal. I'm a product of two parents who grew up in the South, in the segregated South. And I can tell you, just by the stories that they talked about, it was not a good time. And the manifestation of our generation, Generation X, as well as Millennials, which I think the dream of my parents' generation, we're that dream. We're definitely that dream that Dr. King was talking about. And I think where we need to continue this conversation is something that I think a perspective that only we have, in the sense that we were born into a society that really took down the obvious barriers to keeping people whose backgrounds were not the same in terms of ethnicity. Definitely there are still disparities as it relates to income. And as general across the board, some ethnic communities are hit more than others in terms of economics, but just some of the, I think, blatant types of examples from the 40s, the 50s, even before the 40s, because those things were quite tragic. And then how it relates to what we're seeing now, those are things that I think our generations X and millennials. I think that it's time for us to push the dialogue. We know more than anyone how we can do diversity. Diversity is one of those things that we can be good at because we've lived it. And for those in our generation who tend to want to be racist, whether it's blatant or passive aggressive, it is a choice with our generation. That I will. And for those of you listening, if you disagree with me or you've got other thoughts on that, please get social with me. But one thing that I want to talk about is the theory about racism in itself will die. There's this whole thought, and I know in some sociology classes that I had as a Gen Xer, we talked about maybe the possibility of racism dying off when basically the quote-unquote old heads go, meaning those individuals who were alive where it was legal. Once those people pass on, so to speak, and continue the circle of life, racism will die. Well, we now know that it doesn't. And that's why, and maybe the question that I posed, maybe it's subjective. When we talk about racism, has it been redefined or what? But we want to start this dialogue. And my guest today, I think she has written a humorous book describing her life from a millennial perspective, navigating race in a small town in the Midwest. I think her perspective, not only did I find, I found it quite impressive at how she laid out some very difficult situations, but also just knowing that she's a part of a younger generation that now we're watching them become so empowered. I definitely wanted to kick off this conversation on race with her. There'll be other inspiring individuals that I will bring in. This is a multi-part series, but I want to introduce to you the author of Confessions of a Token Black Girl, Danielle Small. Is Danielle on the line?
Yes. Hi, Janet. I'm happy to talk about this on your podcast.
Oh, excellent. Thank you so much. Well, right now we're live here in Los Angeles, and then later on, so we may get some feedback. I'm watching all my social media there because we have some very active listeners that like to give some shout outs. So definitely we'll get into it. One of the things, Danielle, I'd like to just talk to you about is first get a footing of your background. I know in your book you kind of talk a little bit about your education. Can you share with our audience kind of your education in terms of, we'll get to the nitty-gritty of the book at in the Midwest, but kind of where'd you went to college and that kind of thing?
Well, before I moved to Wisconsin, I mean, I was born and raised in Kingston, Jamaica.
Ah.
Yeah, and so I moved to Wisconsin, never really being around a lot of white people before. You know, I came from Kingston, and then before that, we also, like, spent a year in New York. And it was interesting. And then, you know, after Wisconsin, I moved to New York as fast as I could so I could be around a group of people.
Right.
And have culture and all the things that I miss. So, yeah.
Oh, definitely. Well, what you describe is what a lot of people from small towns and particularly in the Midwest, whether black or white, they like to get to large urban areas as quickly as possible, or those bastions of diversity, which, you know, you didn't go wrong with New York. Definitely in terms of diversity, a very diverse place, a place definitely where immigrants are welcome. New York, another place here, you could consider us. Los Angeles, we're also a good place in terms of diversity, too. One of the things I want to ask you about your book, what kind of prompted you to write your book? Because how you write it, it's like a kind of a lot of essays of thoughts going on. What kind of prompted you? What made it click for you to say, "Hey, I need to write this book"?
Well, so when I was younger, I was obsessed with the show All That. And this like sketch comedy show on Nickelodeon for kids.
Yeah.
And I just thought I was going to be a stand-up comic and then like be on All That and then, you know, be on SNL. Like I always wanted to be funny, you know? And in college, you know, when I decided that I wanted to be a writer, I was, you know, trying to find the style of writing that suited me. But at the same time, you know, when I left Wisconsin, you know, like when I was trying to just, you know, kind of just talk to people and, you know, try to stand out in the sea of individuals that is New York, I would tell these stories about Wisconsin and how absurd the racism was. And I would tell them in a, like, really funny way because, as a way as a coping mechanism because, you know, some mm-hmm. of the things that happened were really awful. But, you know, it's kind of like me having the last laugh. And then, you know, I just thought they made these outlandish stories were really entertaining. And for one of my internships, I used to hang out with this journalist. He was like a tech reporter, and I was telling him these stories on a trip that we were taking, and he was like, you know, you should put these in a book. And that's literally what I did. And I worked on it all summer, and then for one of my nonfiction classes, like, we needed like a big final project, so I workshopped it all throughout my nonfiction class. You know, my professor helped out a lot with that, and it took form. That's how it all started.
Got it. And you know, you mentioned your inspiration was All That, and you know, interesting enough, quite a few people refer to All That as not just millennials, but some of us Gen Xers actually refer to that. And I think a lot of it is because a lot of Gen Xers actually were some of the writers and some of the producers of that show, that in terms of kids getting into clean comedy. And for some of our cool baby boomers that are listening, this was a Nickelodeon show, and some very talented young people who are now, some of them are major comedians now, the Kenan and Kel were kind of the two funny mainstays, and Amanda Bynes started out there as well. So definitely great inspiration for that book. Now, in terms of, I kind of want to talk a little bit about some pieces of the book, because I found that your book is something that is really good for generating a lot of discussion when we talk about race. And you mentioned that you, first part of your life, you lived in Jamaica, Kingston, Jamaica. So you immigrated to the United States, and of course, you went to one of the most interesting places to come from. Whereas that's just keeping it nice. Most Americans, when we think of Jamaican immigrants, it's either New York or Miami.
Exactly.
And one of the things that I, if you could just give us a kind of a snippet from your first chapter, because when the reader starts with your book, you come straight out the gate swinging. That's something that I noticed. And you kind of use the Taylor Swift analogy. Can you share with the listeners what that take and why that seemed to be for you the first moment that you wanted to share?
I'm trying to remember the writing process for that. It was when I write, especially like when I'm writing nonfiction, if I'm constantly kind of mulling over a moment in my life that kind of evokes a lot of emotion, mm-hmm. you know, especially if I'm trying to think of a larger piece of work, then I know that's what I need to start with. And I started with Taylor Swift because that Taylor Swift chapter because, you know, back then and especially now, I mean, she's even bigger now, but she's an identifiable type of white woman, you know? So I understand that using her as an analogy for this girl from my class, it would be identifiable on multiple levels. And yeah, so yeah, that's why I made that decision.
Yeah, you didn't play. You did not play. You and for our listeners, it's not in a negative way. It was just like, here it is. We're gonna talk about it, and it gripped. I have to say, as a reader, it gripped me because and after reading that, that's when I said, I want this girl on the show because you map out some things that need to be said. There was a lot of things that you put in that chapter and that you really start out with, and there are just some things that need to be said, and you got it. You nailed it. That's for sure. And another thing that one thing that I wanted to ask you, kind of as it relates to your experience, when you talk about it in comedy, have you found when you talk with other African Americans, have they had similar or parallel type of experiences? I know with you being someone who immigrated into the United States versus someone who may have basically their family has always been in the United States, but they've kind of been in that same type of culture. Have you had that kind of interaction or discussion with individuals like that?
Oh yeah, especially like the first time that my book came out, I got, you know, tons of emails and Twitter DMs about it. People were like, oh my gosh, you know, you said everything that I've ever wanted to say. And then when I wrote that article, especially, like, so many people identified with that. And even when I moved to college, you know, a lot of the Black people that I met at my school, you know, had similar experiences. Because even if you maybe grew up in a Black neighborhood, maybe, you know, if your family had means, maybe you went to a private school that was majority like white people, you know, or, you know, at my college, even though I was happy for the diversity of the city, it was still a lot of white people, like mainly, you know, like they were the majority at the time. And so, yeah, that was actually really surprising for me because the thing about it is living in Wisconsin, so far away in the middle of nowhere, and being pretty much, there was at one point where I was the only, you know, Black person in a town, minus my mother. And yeah, it was crazy. And, you know, you feel so isolated and you feel like you're the only person, but that's not true at all. Like, there are so many people who have this experience, you know, especially like you were talking about earlier in the radio show about, you know, growing up in the age of integration. And with integration comes all these hosts of issues that, you know, maybe weren't anticipated or maybe they were. And this is what happens when, you know, cultures mix, you know?
Exactly. Or they, and it sounds like from where you grew up, it didn't happen. And you were very frank in your book where you talk about your family, basically, it was you and your mother, and then your stepfather obviously was white, and that the only tale of another Black family in that community was 10 years prior, but there something happened in the neighborhood, and that's sort of where it was left. Definitely a lot of folks can resonate with that, and you hit on something very very important for some of our listeners. Within the African American community, we do have different social classes. Some people may not realize it, depending on how you get your news, and who you may interact with. There are different social classes, and just like any group of people, there's a clash among social classes. And particularly in the African American community, there is this, I don't want to use the word pecking order, but, there are, organizations based on economics at who you socialize with. And it's not a way of seeking out. It's almost an evolution. And for some people, it starts with the historically Black fraternities and sororities. And then for others who are born into families of means, a lot of times some may not have heard of this, because there are some Black people that may not know of organizations like Jack and Jill of America or the Lynx Incorporated. But these are other groups within that, I'd say, the well-heeled African-American community of individuals of means, as well as and a lot of these groups are dedicated to charity. Jack and Jill of America, they're dedicated to raising strong families and strong children from those families. And it tends to be the well-to-do families, parents college educated, and a lot of how Jack and Jill of America got started was based on the fact that families of means found themselves in education systems where their children were the only Black children. So, and just hearing and seeing, reading Danielle's book, there's a lot of parallelism. And Danielle, the reason why I wanted to have you here to kick off this discussion is because you're a millennial. And because how you describe things as of year 2001, and you describe things that are similar. Even as myself, growing up as a child in the 70s and 80s, things that I went through as my family was the only Black family in a neighborhood. We were in the South, so that was just a whole different card game. Nonetheless, I had fun too. I identified with your stories. And one of the things that I really want to get your thoughts on, as you, not only that you've written this book, but just kind of your thoughts as a millennial. We seem to be repeating certain things, and your thoughts of maybe what's the best way to start addressing this, because we've gotten to a point in America now where racism has become a political tactic, definitely in our political system with the the two parties. They like to use race. One likes to pimp race. You've got the Republicans that like to pimp race as something that as if it's a card that people play, which both sides, whether you're Black or white or Asian or Latino, anybody's playing that card. If you're complaining about it, you play it first. And then you've got Democrats, where the perception is that race is being played, that there's some boogeyman that's out there trying to get you. As a millennial, and in terms of your thoughts of what I call political nonsense, just your thoughts at what might be the best way to deal with this?
Well, what's helped me through a lot of reading and a lot of thinking is, one, recognizing that racism is more than hurt feelings. Racism is a system of oppression. I mean, we are a society whose economy was built on the back of slaves. Like, racism fueled that. Without racism, you couldn't have dehumanized people to the point where they were property. Yeah. And so acknowledging that, because then once you acknowledge that, then you can do away with a certain argument. Like, I grew up, like, a lot of, especially white people, think that just because they're not a Donald Trump, or, they don't wear, the KKK garments, then that means they're not racist or they're not complicit in a racist society. But when you understand that it's actually a system of oppression, like, where that houses everything, then you realize that it's not just about, saying the N-word, but it's also for white people to recognize their privilege. And for me, as a Black person, dealing with the fact that I internalized so many harmful things about myself because of, racist media and, all these things that make up this system of oppression, for me, it's been focusing on how can, one, I build myself up as a Black person and then help and build up other Black people, and, you know, really focusing on, you know, strengthening that community, because that's where our strength comes from. You know, it's not about, you know, it's just not about hate. And, you know, I hate the system of oppression. I have some resentment about my experiences, but like I said, it's a lot bigger than hurt feelings and name calling.
Yeah, I agree. And just as another thought, you know, that's on the other side, the oppressive side. What about the thoughts of the perceived victim mentality? Because at the same time, we do have to recognize, yes, there are some people who may not recognize their white privilege. There are some people who may not have, and there are some people who have gone their lives not interacting with a person of color, not just Black people, period. But, you know, they may inadvertently, and in their mind, they literally may think they're not racist, but in their mind, they could be attaching to those kinds of behaviors. And at the same time, a person of color could also be imitating that same thing back to quote unquote the oppressor. You know, in those, have you had those kinds of situations that you feel like you're in the middle because of what you've gone through and what you've witnessed, where you see both sides of the fence?
There's been an evolution of my life. So, you know, especially, I mean, I also have to factor in my background. And a lot of Jamaicans don't see racism in terms of in the U.S. as a big problem. Like, you know, there's a lot of, like, you know, we don't take African-American struggles seriously. And so kind of grew up with that coming into America. And then I honestly, there was a time where I was just like, yeah, I felt like a victim, and then I emulated, you know, to fit in. You know, I was very young. I tried to fit in with my peers by making racist remarks myself, you know, saying things, playing into stereotypes, or trying to distance myself from stereotypes. Like, there was a time when I couldn't even eat fried chicken in front of people because I just didn't want them to say anything.
Okay. And I think that's what you kind of describe. And in your book, you say that the copyright's pending, but something that you describe as your race elimination program, is that a part of that?
Yes, I tried to. I thought if I was the best Black person that I could be, that there would be no more racism. They could not find, or at least the people in my town could not find any more reason to hate Black people. And I just, one, that was too much of a burden to bear for like a preteen/teenager. And, you know, it's just useless. I just realized, like, I can't change people's mind. I mean, I'm still friends with some people on Facebook. I have to unfriend every day because they may know me, but they're still awful.
Their mindset's kind of jacked up.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I just, yeah.
Yep, I feel you.
That they have to do to justify a lot of their feelings. And I'm just like, we played together. I was at your house. We ate dinner together, and I'm just like, you know,
That's kind of a special thing, and what you describe, and to our listeners, I think listeners of color, I'm sure you are feeling what she's saying, and to our listeners who are not. Who are kind of hearing this and hearing this interesting, and definitely I know my friends who are listening, they know we talk about this all the time. You describe what most Black people and any person of color feels like sometimes in certain situations, like we're representing the whole race. It's basically the interaction with me, I could jack it up for everybody else, you know,
kind of. Exactly. Better not mess up.
Exactly. Yeah, no, you can't carry the weight of everybody. And you're absolutely right. You're right about that. Now, one thing that you pointed out that you talked about that I want to get back to was, you know, you talked about the mindset that some Jamaicans have. And, you know, this is something that's been going on forever. Actually, even back in my day in college, we used to have these discussions about with exchange students, actually. We would have open forums with exchange students from the Caribbean, black students, international students from the Caribbean who were studying in the States, and we would talk about blackness and what it means to be black, and kind of their assimilation was completely different from blacks born and raised here in the States. And there is, and you, in what you mentioned, is a slight difference. And in some of our discussions, there's that mentality, it, you know, when we talk about that victim mentality, some of it, depending on what part of the Caribbean, some Caribbean blacks have mentioned that a lot of it relates to slavery in terms of, because, you know, just kind of a slight, small history lesson for our listeners. Slaves were not only brought to the United States, but they were also brought to islands within the Caribbean, and even in, as well as, you know, in South America and islands off of South America like Curacao. But you have islands like Jamaica, you have islands like Aruba and Haiti, Barbados. And there is this mindset, or I'd say this theory that because in the States, blacks in the States, slaves in the States kind of complied versus in the Caribbean where people kind of overthrew. And I mean, the most prominent example is what happened in Haiti, where in Haiti, the French were run off. And then from Haiti, slaves went over and liberated the Dominican Republic. And actually, Haiti became the first black nation, a full black nation as a result of that. And you kind of touched on that in terms of how maybe some Jamaicans may not feel the message of what's going on in black America.
Yeah, I mean, I like to look at it this way. When I lived in Jamaica, and when I go back to Jamaica, I don't feel black, you know, mm-hmm. because I just exist, you know. In America, I'm constantly reminded of my otherness, but in Jamaica, I am just another person going about my business. And I can see how, especially for members of my family who have lived there and lived there all their lives, and you know, rarely in America, it's really hard to understand unless you experience it in America. And even though I've, you know, grown up in America for, like, you know, since age 10, there's still a little bit of difference for me, because I'm not being a second-class citizen in my own country, because Jamaica is my country. Like, I have a home. I have a, you know, nationality, I have a flag, we have our songs, we have, you know, I know where I come from. And I always think, I can't imagine what it must be like to be born into this country and then be treated as a second-class citizen. I mean, it's really hard to imagine if that's not what's happening to you. And so, yeah, there's just this, like, misunderstanding. So it's easy when you're in Jamaica and you have a black prime minister and everybody looks like you, and in the commercials, people look like you, and on the TV shows, people look like you. I mean, we have our problems. There's a lot of colorism there. Like, I will say that.
Okay.
But it's easy to look at black Americans and be like, oh, well, it's not that serious, because it's not that serious for Jamaicans, even though there are a lot of, I mean, it's a complicated history, but on a cultural level, yeah, it's not that serious. Yeah.
Got it. Yeah. That, I think that's always something to that seems to be a discussion even within the black community. One of the things that another thing from your book that I want to talk to you about that I found hilarious was the chapter on the racial litmus test, where you describe your spidey sense. how did that come about? I think because all of us who have been through a similar situation, you do know, you it's one of these things where as a coping mechanism, you know how and who you can navigate around and be with. But at the same time, I think as you evolve, you do develop this whole, you basically can call it when you see it kind of thing. And how did you come up with your list? I howled when I saw this.
Well, I mean, you said it. It's like a coping mechanism. Like, you know, all these microaggressions, they were exhausting mentally. And I was just like, you know what? I need to take notes of the traits that people have who are causing me all this stress. So I just came up with a list. I remember writing it down in my notebook because I'm always carrying a notebook with me, and I'm just like ticking it off. And like whenever I would meet someone, like I would go through this mental list and be like monitoring what they're saying. And it's like, oh, yep. And then I would wait. I would wait to see. You know, first I would try not to be too judgmental. I'd be like, okay, so they, you know, did not pass the test. Let's see how they actually act. And honestly, it was like 99% correct.
Oh, my gosh.
Correct. It's just, yeah. And I could, the list could be longer, honestly, you know.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. you termed it right, microaggressions. And what's, based on the microaggressions that you've seen, what's been the number one thing that you find good people with? Because we all know good people. I know me personally, good people, they can look you in the eye. It's the people mm-hmm. who's got the issues. They break eye contact with you. They're always uncomfortable and they start breathing heavy. That's how you know. And usually I kind of help them out a little bit and make them feel a little comfortable. And they have to know I know, but you sort of got to let them know. In your experience, how do you know the good people?
Honestly, there just has to be a sort of authenticity, like mm-hmm. an honesty. Because I don't expect people to be perfect, because God knows I'm not perfect. Like, you know, it's not like I've never said a prejudiced thing in my life, you know.
Right.
But there just has to be an acknowledgement of that imperfection. You know, when they don't act like they know everything, mm-hmm. you know, then that's the starting point, because we can grow together, you know?
Exactly. So. Yeah. That's a great point. I think it's also not only that they know everything or that they're throwing out stereotype judgments. Because I've had people that just come straight to me and they'll just say, hey, you know, I don't want to sound offensive, but I really haven't had much experience being around African Americans. That I can take. Yeah. And that's sincere.
Exactly. It's sincerity. You hit it right on the nose. Just be sincere, you know?
Exactly.
And not, you know, and also, you know, don't touch my hair.
Well, here in Los Angeles, people have kind of gotten that. And I think pretty much television has done a good job, just in general. You really shouldn't touch anybody's hair, but if you really want to get jacked up, don't touch a black woman's hair. Just don't. And don't. And I always tell my friends, I am the exception, not the rule. You can throw me in a pool, because I don't have hair issues. But just make sure, I said, I will jack you up if you didn't look at my feet and see what shoes I'm wearing. Because if I'm wearing my good shoes, I'm going to jack you up over my shoes, not my hair. So, you know, definitely those kinds of things. And I think taking a humorous look at these things are, you nailed it in terms of how to deal with this and even how to tell the story. And I appreciated the book. I identified with your entire situation, even though mine was almost 30 some years before your situation. What I want to kind of change gears a little bit and talk to you about, and it's kind of based on your article that you wrote for Salon Magazine a couple of weeks ago. You in jest, you kind of mentioned too, we know that You didn't get any love from your hometown, but then at the same time, you didn't really get too much. There were these assumptions with Black folk that you came in contact with, which a lot of us get that too. Can you just share some of your perspective of even when you wrote that article, kind of how you talked about the quote unquote Black test?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I've been lucky in that department because to me, a lot of this stemmed from my own anxiety. Because after being isolated for so long, and I was like, I was so mad when I realized it. I was just like, after all I've been through, I can't even like be comfortable around my own people because I feel like, you know, I'm just gonna fail this imaginary or whatever test, you know. And I was so mad, and I'm not cool, you know. I will say it. I am not cool at all. Nobody's ever gonna say, "Oh, Danielle is the coolest person." I'm not suave. I'm sure I walk weird or something, and I'm just
you have no soul.
I have no soul. I keep a beat because I'm still Jamaican. But I two-step. That's my safety zone. I just two-step. That's as much as I can do, you know. And especially because, like, I didn't even listen to popular music. I was such a nerd. My father's a jazz musician. And I listened to just mainly jazz and classical music until I was, like, 17.
Uh-huh.
So my cultural identifiers were different. He would be, like, talking about Ludacris. And I'd be like, so what do you think about Vivaldi? You know, it's like, no, Danielle. I'm fortunate in that no Black person has actually outright come and said it. Like, they've acknowledged that I'm just weird and nerdy, but they've never said to me that I'm not Black. While I've had friends who have had the opposite experience, like I, you know, talked about my friend, she grew up in Harlem her whole life, but because she listened to metal music and she was just kind of like a scene kid, she got told she wasn't white by so many of her peers, and it was really traumatizing for her because, you know, these are, you know, she goes to school with Black people, her, you know, she's in a Black family, and yet she's kind of being ostracized for alternative interests. I mean, and then, you know, I have been made fun a little bit by other Jamaicans. That's the extent of my teasing by other Black people, but, I mean, other than that, you know, like my hairdresser whose handshake that I could not reciprocate, she just thinks it's weird. You know, she thinks I'm a hoot by how weird I am. But she's never going to be like, you know, she's never told me that, oh, you're not Black, you know. But I know that other people have experienced the inverse of that, so.
Got it, yeah. And sometimes, too, they know who to approach. And there are other words that they call some folks that are not in the know. And definitely, Danielle, you could hang out at my house the whole time because classical music was all that was allowed in our house. Although, my brother and I would, you know, we'd sneak in some Dougie Fresh and the Get Fresh crew and that kind of stuff. But, you know, you mentioned that you... the comedy, the inspiration, the All That show. I just want to ask you because, you know, in your bio, you're still in school and you're still doing a lot of different things. Is there a plan to take a career in comedy or do a one-woman show on these experiences?
You know, I'm not really sure. You know, other than being inspired, like, comedians and stuff, and yeah, I graduated college
a year
and a half ago, but you know, I'm inspired, other than comedians, I'm inspired by my grandmother, and honestly, you can't even, like, her resume is like 5 pages long. She is a playwright, an actress, a professor. She's put on one-woman shows. She literally just got honored by the French government, like, received their highest honor for who knows what at, like, you know, 80 for you know, she's not young, but she's still doing it, you know. Uh-huh. And so I don't know if there's like one certain career path for me, but I do want to keep writing and I do want to keep delving deep into this process. And I might, you know, I mean, I've been entertaining the thought of taking some writing classes at UCB and just getting more into it, because comedy is something that I enjoy and I find that it's the best way to cope, because whenever there's a new hashtag, you know, you know, it's awful, and the way I deal is by watching all these hilarious vines that black people create, or like checking out what's going on with black Twitter, always doing something funny, and you know, then writing on my own stuff. Like I'm working on a few things, trying to write another book. But yeah, so, you know, you'll just see where my various paths take me, but I'm just having fun. And
well, it's been awesome. And if I could just give you a little encouragement, because the way you write, I'm thinking I could see this young woman on the stage cutting it up a little bit, you know, giving us a little bit of the, you know, the story, the way it's happening in Wisconsin, and then on the side, giving us a little Jamaican accent the way, and just telling us, breaking it down how it really is. I can see it. And I was... That's what gripped me and had me laughing the entire time.
I'm so glad. I'm really happy about that.
Good. Well, Danielle, where can listeners get your book? Because I want them to experience what I experienced. And we kind of gave, you know, audience, we gave you a little taste of Danielle's story. And where can I get your book?
You can only get it, I think it's on iTunes as well, but it's on Amazon. It's only in an ebook format. So,
okay.
Yeah, Google it on Amazon or iTunes.
Okay, on iTunes. I got it on Amazon, and Amazon's not paying me, but Amazon could give us a call, though.
Get that affiliate money.
definitely, listeners, definitely check out Danielle's book, Confessions of a Token Black Girl. And Danielle, do you have social media contacts where people can follow your escapades, your thoughts?
Yeah, follow me on Twitter. I try to make it interesting. My Twitter handle is Danielle, DanielleE, Abeda, Abeda.
Okay. Great. And we'll also put that on our show page, as well as we'll tweet that out as well for our listeners. Danielle, just in closing, just your thoughts, just in general, as a millennial, as we see race, how do you see maybe the sophisticated among your generation, millennials? Because you think a little bit different than my generation, Gen Xers. How do you see your generation addressing racism?
I think we have a lower tolerance for it, for sure. I think with growing up, you know, it's interesting because my generation, you know, we kind of grew up with both worlds. You know, I grew up reading books, and then, you know, I got older and like was more into the internet, you know, but I still remember using paper and having to use dial-up to connect to the internet and all of that, and playing outside, like that was a thing. But, you know, we grew up, by the time we were, you know, preteens and teenagers, we grew up all with having this vast amount of information at our fingertips, so we no longer, you know, having to go through gatekeepers to get information about, you know, things that are relevant to us. So I think that has produced a very low tolerance for racism, and you can see it in, you know, social media, where especially young people are willing to just call out anybody when they're being racist or, you know, homophobic or, you know, whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. So I think that's great, because as a person who grew up in a place very white, and I was always afraid to confront people about it, you know,
mm-hmm.
Even if it was damaging to me. So, yeah, I mean, most of my friends are writers, and they write about it very candidly, you know, for the Huffington Post or like other, you know, platforms. And so I I see us just being more open, less tolerant of bigotry, and, you know, really just focusing on progressing as a society. You know, we're tired of it. You know, we're, so many generations have gone through it. We want to see real change.
Oh, excellent. Great thoughts. And I just want to thank you again, and thank you for spending some time with us. And certainly, we will certainly keep up and keep watch out for you. And audience, again, the name of the book is called Confessions of a Token Black Girl, written by Danielle Small. And Danielle, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Excellent. Thank you. It was a treat for us, and you've kicked off an important series of conversations that we will have here on the Janet Foster Show. And audience, I just want to tell you, enjoy your Labor Day weekend, and we will be right back here, same time, same place next week, and have a wonderful week and a wonderful day. Thank you.